let's talk about the advisory bodies. I don't know, you probably haven't had much opportunity to watch ICOMOS and ICOM, but in terms of IUCN, how do you assess their performance? What are the constraints? And in a way, how did you, must have been under your regime that you called for an evaluation of the World Heritage Program, and what did that produce?
Yeah. So first of all, I don't know. I knew our colleagues from ICOMOS and ICROM, yes. And they always told us that their job was much more complicated because the cultural sites are more political, more in the eyes of the politicians than the natural sites, which are far away and so on. I mean, obviously, as I have just said, I think that natural sites also were part of the political discussions, but not as much. And so, and I'd also heard, even before I went to IUCN, that the IUCN way of looking at the criteria and the way of analyzing the nominations was very deep and very serious. Again, it probably is easier in the natural sciences, where there's very specific criteria. We worried about, can we select people who understand these particular issues that are being presented in a specific nomination? So we were always driven by the evidence base that we needed rather than the political correctness. And we had good people. I think one of the challenges is finding people who have the time to be able to get away from their teaching or their research and to go out to look at sites, to interview people, to really look at the issue from a 360 degrees. Wasn't that easy, and we never had enough funding. So we really needed people who were dedicated to the World Heritage Convention, and there are quite a few. We needed more. The evaluation, that I was very, very supportive of the proposal. Everybody needs to be evaluated. IUCN itself has an external review every 4 years. And we were committed to addressing the issues that were raised as needing more help. It's a healthy thing to do.
Was that the main finding of the 2013 evaluation, was a lack of funding?
Yes. Well, that was one of it. The lack of funding and I think the political okay. pressures. Yeah. Yes. So the lack of funding, I think, has always been a problem. And IUCN, I believe, even when I was there, we succeeded in getting some complementary funds, non-UNESCO funds from a foundation, for example. And I remember speaking to the foundation, making the case at their board meeting and stressing the fact that IUCN really was created to think deeply about the science of conservation, but not to stop there. That would be very nice, but we were not professors and researchers, but to make sure that our science is influences policy. And the World Heritage Convention is a great instrument for that.
Yeah.
We did that with other conventions as well, but I would say that we had the most specifically identified role in the World Heritage Conventions.
One of the positions that often came from IUCN on that point was the idea that in some ways selecting certain properties to be outstanding against the bigger backdrop of protected areas was perhaps detrimental to the other protected areas. Do you share that view?
While I was at IUCN, we had agreed on different categories of protection, which I think was very, very reasonable and sensible of us, and it was a big argument. But for example, protected areas where people live, like let's say the Ngorongoro crater, I think that's also a World Heritage Site, but there are people who actually live there. They didn't have to be thrown out to be a natural site. So we had these five categories already, and the jewel in the crown everybody saw was the World Heritage Sites. I do think the countries have to understand the difference between the different kind of categories. It's not a hierarchy, really, and actually perhaps it's not even fair to call it the jewel in the crown. It's just a different way of protecting.